Hello, everybody, and welcome to the News Paste podcast with me, Johnny Vedmore. My guest today has been a thorn in the side of those who write our official history books for a long time now. And like other researchers and journalists who are inspecting the official narrative, he tends to find the answers from around during World War II and the post-war formation of what we describe as a new world order and all its many tentacles. When I first spoke with Tony Gosling, I was very much at the start of my own journey towards becoming a semi-professional, I'd say, independent investigative journalist. And if I was to look back at all of his work then, I fear that much of it would have gone over my head. However, today, times have changed, because after years of research, I understand that many of the events Tony covers are actually marked the birth of our current political world order. The building blocks that make the what we see today made what we see today possible. So, welcome Tony Gosling to the News Paste podcast. I'm happy to have you on.
Oh, thanks, Johnny. Thanks very much for asking me.
No, oh, well, it's. I mean, I think our paths were always meant to cross to some sort of extent. It's so difficult. When I first started out, I was I'm not sure which direction to go in. I was constantly moving from one area to another, trying to find the articles and the stories that made sense of things to other people. But I didn't have so much in the way of sense of a proportion and scale and historical understanding of what had actually happened at the time. And of course, it was really my looking into Klaus Schwab's history, his family history, discovering about his father's work for the Nazis, and then his joining of a CIA-funded program to train young global leaders out of Harvard called Kissinger's International Seminar, and everything that come from that. It's kind of that's led me to really have to go back to the stage where you're at. And everybody, as I get closer, everybody's screaming not only your name, but names like Bormann and etc. And you're obviously the expert. So how did you get here?
Well, look, just to start with, this is a grooming program you're talking about, which was instituted really around about the time of World War II to tap up young, often sons and daughters of powerful criminals of various sorts in order to make them the new leaders. So the idea is it's almost like a kind of genetic, you know, we want our kids to be the great leaders of tomorrow. We're criminals, but, you know, you can't, obviously, as Schwab's father was involved in the Nazi nuclear program, and which a lot of people try and forget about. But it was, you know, if you think about the logic of it all, the atom was split in Berlin just before World War II. I mean, all the experts were in Hungary and Eastern Europe and Germany. So, of course, they're going to have a nuclear program. And what you've described, your experience of sort of stepping out of this, shall we say, comfortable bubble of what we're supposed to believe. In fact, a lot of it is very uncomfortable on a subconscious level. Yeah. You find this like a minefield, a conspiracy minefield, I'd describe it, with all sorts of extremely powerful, important, true, real conspiracies, peppered with a whole load of total and utter deliberate rubbish. Mm-hmm. So this is a sort of barrier for many people. They think, well, look, I mean, I just don't have the time or the headspace to go through all this. And this is where one specific book really comes in handy. And you won't be surprised here, it's not mine. It's a book by David Southwell called Secrets and Lies. Mm-hmm. Now, David is an old mate of mine. I mean, we've had our differences over the years. He's now, I think he's kind of gotten into the London establishment for our benefit rather than for his own. But anyway, he was very seriously ill for a while. His pedigree, David's pedigree, was writing a book called The History of Organized Crime, which, of course, is a fascinating topic. And it's a very, very good book looking at mainly UK, but obviously America.
Links up well to intelligence agencies, seeing as they basically morphed into being the same thing at some point.
Well, yes, and drug dealing and funny money and banking. And I mean, one of the stories he tells in there is about Charlie Richardson, one of the South London gangsters who finally, under Harold Wilson in the 1970s, was jailed And when he came out of jail after something 7 years or something in prison in the 1980s, he walked straight into a job in the City of London.
Isn't that the way? Yes.
And this is the world we're in now. Is there's no need to go robbing banks, you know, because obviously all the criminals are now running and controlling them. And as we've seen with the cancellation, I was just hearing today of Debbie Hicks, who's one of the campaigners in the south of England around cash, for example, though she travels all around the country now. She's had her bank accounts shut down. We had Nigel Farage having his bank accounts shut down, this sort of thing. So the banksters are just sending messages to all of us. Look, this is actually a religion. You don't even realize you're part of it. Money is a religion. It's an act of faith. And we're slowly asserting our power and control over you because we are the high priests in that religion, these bankers. And then we have Michael Tyler a few years ago. It's about 4 years ago. Michael's a blogger that lives on a canal boat. And he's one of those brilliant journos that has just decided, right, I'm going to look into this story. And it was him that came up with this list of over 100 dead bankers. This is about 2017, 2018, 2019, during that period. A whole load of bankers just committed suicide, as you would if you're a super rich person, shooting themselves in the head twice and electrocuting themselves in the bath. So there was an absolute massacre of bankers at the time. And what I'm thinking is that, you know, these are ones that are not part of the cult, you know, that are running. Anyway, David's book, Secrets and Lies, is a sort of coffee table thing, but it's like salvation to anybody in your situation, Johnny, where you're thinking, where do I start? You know, because he's got a page, every page has got another conspiracy, which he gives you enough information in there, some lovely glossy pictures too, of how to check for yourself. And he says right at the start, look, don't believe me. I've just dug all this information out. Anyway, he's done a beautiful job with that. And I think it helps anybody that's in the same sort of situation as I was originally when I left the BBC. And you obviously were, after we first, pretty much the time we first spoke, Johnny, to get your head around and navigate that minefield.
Yeah, and obviously we're all on our own journeys, and you've come from what me and others would say establishment media, but you've seen that there's a load of there's a whole curtain to draw back, and that they're not drawing back that curtain at all. Instead, it's left for these other researchers, and I don't think people understand the power of the gentleman you were just talking about who's written Secret and Lies. What was his name again, sorry?
David Southwell.
Well, I obviously got to know David Southwell, because that's the type of thing that I'm desperate for. I'm desperate for people to give me the idea of where to look without it being, oh, look, this is the most popular topic or a really popular topic that we all want to know about, more about, even though we know everything about it. We just want you to go there because it's the only thing we know. It's actually in between the lines of the popular topics where all of the truth is, where all of the real stuff is happening. And I suppose as well, I've had a lot of research recently. I've done a lot of research into that era that you kind of talked about in London, where the gangsters were about, and the changeover from gangsters merging with intelligence. Basically, through the late 50s, I researched in the same way that you're talking about bankers dying there. I researched I found out that over a year and a half, a string of women who own nightclubs in the most poshest part of London all died in all mysterious ways. And then all of those clubs were taken over by all of the gangsters and intelligence-linked mobsters that would eventually be, would all be betrayed by the intelligence or become intelligence. And this would eventually lead to things like the Claremont set and the people in London, like the clubs in London, which ran the show. You know, this was the birth of that, the gangsters and the intelligence, the gangsters realizing that they could not beat intelligence and they had to join them. And I think we see a lot of this all trying to understand how where to look there, I was asked to go and look into the craze and the ownership of Esmeralda's Barn. And now everybody knows about the craze, but as soon as you start looking at something like Esmeralda's Barn, a nightclub in London that no one really knows about but had a lot of activity back then, and you start researching it, you discover there's a whole world, and it's like a lot of it is known, but it's forgotten. And so,
yeah, but I think, Johnny, at the time, a lot of this stuff was getting reported. It was splashed on the tabloid press. And one of the things I think very, very few people understand is the change that happened in our press between the 1970s and the 1990s, really through the Thatcher era. I mean, we're now dealing with the privatization of water, aren't we? You know, and all the things that Thatcher sold off, now owned by Chinese companies who just want to milk us for everything they can. You know, so it's like the Romans over in Beijing, we're having to pay tribute to them. So, I mean, it was a complete disaster, Thatcherism. But what people don't understand is that battle that happened in Wapping with the print unions and the journalists unions and Rupert Murdoch and obviously Eddie Shah, various other media moguls, was so important. I mean, I interviewed for a journalist union oral history project here in Bristol, some of the journalists who've been working right through since the Second World War, who were retiring. And it was fascinating to hear their take on this as journalists was that we had a relationship with printers. We got paid by the proprietor, but our relationship was with the printers and the editor. And so they would get commissioned to do stories. They'd sometimes just dig out their own stories. They were left very much to their own, trusted to get on with the job. And what people don't understand is the complete difference that happened with the computerization and that Murdoch was doing in Wapping. I was gobsmacked to hear this, but the journalists were saying, this particular guy was saying, we used to take send the copy down to the print room, and then we get a phone call from downstairs. Okay, the page is made up now. So as a journalist, usually late in the afternoon or in the evening, we'd go down into the print room to check our story, and the printer, and there was a line right between the printing machine and where the journalist was allowed to stand, and they would read their story backwards that had been typeset in hot metal, and they'd read the story, check it, and sign the story off. So the journalist union and the print union were the only people between the story and the public, if you see what I mean. So the editor really didn't get involved. You had subs obviously doing headlines, and layout of the page was really controlled by subs. But it was a very, very trusted thing that the unions enforced in a draconian way, right? So they understood the journalists must get their information to the public via a printer, and we're not having anyone messing around with it. So that was what got broken by Murdoch, that whole system. I mean, obviously the print unions were basically destroyed. The journalist union, NUJ, is still there. And so, for example, with the 7/7 London bombings, there was these little anomalies I find absolutely fascinating. So Mark Honigsbaum on The Guardian was down at the London bombings in 2005, and he recorded a little podcast for The Guardian website outside Edgware Road in Marks and Spencer's, where there were a lot of people who'd come out from the bombings and were kind of, you know, in M&S, kind of getting cups of tea and things like that. And so he'd spoken to them, and he did a little podcast on the day. Anyway, the next day's paper, the day after the bombings, is an article by Mark Honigsbaum appears in The Guardian. The only thing is it contradicts what he said the day before. So the day before he says the bombs were under the trains, and he says it twice in his little podcast. Mm-hmm. This is what people were telling him as they were coming out. And then in the article in the newspaper, it says the bomb was inside the trains. And so about maybe it must be a month after the bombings, Johnny, I phoned him up at The Guardian. I said, Mark, how do you explain this difference between what you said on the day and your podcast and what appeared in the in your article the next day? And it was a brilliant sort of silence on the other end of the line. And he said, well, Tony, not everything I submit as copy appears in the next day's paper.
Boom. Yeah. Yeah. Someone else is deciding how to... that is a real... That is fundamentally editing... A base level as low, as close to the bone as you can go.
a terrorist attack in real time being interpreted. Another example is the Al Sadr newspaper in Iraq. There was a massive suicide bombing in Baghdad, and it was all over the world. Something like 20 people killed in a bus queue not long after Tony Blair's wonderful project and started. And in the Al Sadr newspaper in Iraq, their headline the next day was missile fired from helicopter, right? So the eyewitnesses in Iraq had been saying there's a helicopter fired a missile into the bus queue, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's an American helicopter or a British helicopter. It's one of the occupying forces. There's nobody else mm-hmm. allowed to fly in there. Just blew up a whole load of people in a bus queue. It might be there was one person in that queue that had some information that they wanted assassinated or executed.
Yeah, and
so we've had this story go all the way around the world. Isn't it terrible? A suicide bomb has done this in Baghdad, but actually on the ground there. And you know what happened the next day? As soon as that been published in the Al Sadr newspaper, the Bremer's American forces come in and shut the paper down. Right.
They just
come into the offices, take all the computers, arrest everybody, release them bit by bit. But that newspaper is now out of circulation, out of action. There's a very great interest by the military and by the intelligence services in every single story. And this is just coming back to this week. Okay, so there was I don't know if you remember last week in Kramatorsk, in the war zone in eastern Ukraine, there was a bomb attack on a pizza restaurant. I don't know if you picked this one up, but
no, I didn't.
There were 12 people. So it was a missile attack by the Russians on a pizza restaurant, and this has gone all around the Western world in the press. Oh, isn't it evil Russians? They're just killing random people in pizza restaurants. Well, you start to look at the footage, and you can see there's all military people being helped out of the place. So there's obviously a few military, well, it's a war zone, so you'd expect that. And then on the BBC bulletin last Tuesday night, 6 o'clock, which I recorded, you've got they said in that bulletin, oh, and there were 4 British people injured. So you think to yourself, interesting, let's see if we can find that on the internet anywhere. No. But so what are these 4 people doing there from Britain? Are they on holiday in the war zone? Are they lost? Have they managed to sort of stumble into Kramatorsk by mistake and decided, right, we don't know where we are, so let's go and get ourselves a pizza?
Been a long night.
So this is what I'm saying is that it is, I think, in real time, the media is really strategically lying to us all the time now, particularly to do with the everything to do with Ukraine. The war there is utter. In fact, I even overheard some, I guess they would be military strategic communications people in a Morrison's cafe, as this was all started, sort of bragging about, you know, oh, we had some journalist that thought he could say what he wanted about this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we just got him, we put him in his place. And they didn't actually say they got him sacked, but that's what they do. They will
They only got to get rid of the ones who have got a good enough voice and who are concise enough to be able to say their points and make their points salient enough to slip into the public rhetoric. There is a question that when I was listening to all of that was just rolling around in my head. I just could not stop thinking about it. Like, I wonder, and you're probably not going to have the answer, but I think we can both estimate them. I think we'll both know the answer. But compared to that scene you paint now in eastern Ukraine, in the war zone, and people who are fighting in a war zone like that, compared to World War II, actual frontline World War II action, how many of the 100 random troops or 1,000 random troops would you say were heavily intelligence trained back in World War II compared to now? I'm wondering if it was actually like, you know, there's only 1 or 2% back then who had significant enough intelligence training. And nowadays, I wonder if there's actually more people on the ground who are intelligence than there are military fighters actually firing guns and attacking the other side. It seems to be that we are seriously, this fifth generation warfare is the whole thing. That nothing is as it seems anymore. And this Ukrainian war has been a hyper normalization of the greatest guy. Some of the clips that you see on the news, it means that they're not even trying to hide that there's fakery going on. So I mean, how do you where are we? Where are we, Tony? You're well, a guy who's got a lot of experience in this.
Okay, there's lots of warfare everywhere, but it's like you say, it's there's a fantastic amount of money being plowed into psychological warfare because it's been very successful in the past. I mean, it was I suppose it was during World War II and the D-Day landings that there was a Dennis Wheatley, the writer, was one of the major deception planners for that, making all these inflatable tanks so the German reconnaissance would see them classic. Think there was a massive force. And they succeeded there in pinning down five divisions for about 6 weeks, waiting for the invasion at Calais that never came. So this is an incredibly, incredibly effective piece of work. Mm-hmm. And they would argue, well, it's, you know, it's ethical because we weren't actually killing people, blah, blah. So they learned a lot from Wheatley. Although Wheatley is never talked about, he's completely taboo nowadays because he was a brilliant guy and a genius and a brilliant writer on the occult, you know, the sort of black magic and things like that. Mm-hmm. And just generally a very good historian. He did a couple of really good books. One is on the Russian Revolution, the history of that, and another one on the English Civil War, which is a terrific look at the history of what happened to mostly to do with Charles II, actually. Bit about Charles I, but the kings, you know, because they were basically
fantastic. It's fantastic.
I mean, you know, it's a bit of a rabbit hole, but the English Civil War was one of the most important things that ever happened. We don't really get talked about.
Okay, just before you say that, I mean, some of my audience know about this, and you may know about this. I don't know, but my father was Colonel John Birch of Colonel John Birch's regiment of foot. And I was brought up in the 17th century. I was in the sealed knot. So my father, when I was about 4 or 5 years old, he set up Colonel John Birch's regiment of foot, 13 militia from, it was between 6,000 and 8,000 people who were members of the sealed knot then. And for people who don't understand what this is, campsite, loads of people partying all weekend, families turn up, caravans, etc., and then we all dress up in 17th century costumes, get our muskets on, get our swords out, get the armor on, put the pikes up in front, and march off with drums, whistles, and water carriers galore, and there's real gunpowder, and there's birds, and they fight for in front of a spectacle for crowds of I mean, my dad run musters that were like 16,000 people would turn up, and back then they were paying like £5-10 to get in, and it was a wonderful day of festivities, really good family stuff, watching like the reenactment of war outside various castles. Well, I spent every weekend doing that, so I explored the 17th century in ways that many people didn't, because my dad was so into it, he set up his own regiment, and that regiment ended up getting to about 250 people, regular people, who, I mean, these regiments were like close family then. You're recruiting friends. You, when you go to a seal knot campsite, you're all camped with your regiment in your tertio, and so you get to know history in a different way. So I find the English Civil War amazing, and my history teacher used to force me to bring in costumes and tell people about the English Civil War.
From I think you have to take a sort of view from the moon of it, really, because the English Civil War was a battle between the feudal classes in England and the merchant classes, and it was started really by the City of London, and the war against Charles the First, it's interestingly we now got number three, of course, was initiated mainly because he had been overturning enclosures. So there have been enclosures, a lot of enclosures of land, privatization of land, where people have been turfed out of their homes. You know, if you go around the countryside now, you often find the footings of these old houses from the 14th, 15th century, and small settlements, which were basically like massive allotments around the houses. So they started enclosing these villages, which was evicting the people and turning over the land over mostly to sheep. Anyway, it was a modern kind of form of farming. They called it modernization, but it ended up with lots of people being evicted. And Charles I started fining the landowners who'd been evicting people in the 1630s. And they didn't like it because this was part of a plan and set off by John Dee in the Elizabethan era for a British empire. The idea was evict all these people. Let's start growing a massive surplus of food in an industrial scale, which was the agricultural revolution. Yeah. And let's get all these people to work in factories, building things like ships and guns.
Very similar to what happened in Ireland in the late 1700s and early 1800s as well.
So anyway, so the point is that the empire was planned. I don't really think Charles I quite understood or went along with the way the empire was supposed to be being built. And what he saw was loads of families, kids sleeping in ditches and things like this. And he's saying, no, you've got to stop this. These people are growing their own food. They're doing fine. They're producing a bit of a surplus. They're there for military service if we need them. And this is a system I don't want the merchant classes, the City of London, overturning. So eventually, you know, the empire did happen because we had there was a counter civil war with Charles II being brought back as king. But then after that, the Orange men won the day. The Masons won the day by bringing back in King Billy in the Glorious Revolution at the end of the 1600s. So they won. I mean, okay, so we had a few years. In fact, it was a brilliant time, the Restoration, Charles II. There was all these plays being performed in London where the establishment was lampooned. It was like amazing. It was like the 1960s, you know.
They run the banks into the ground as well, I think, during that period.
That's right. The Bank of England was set up after the Glorious Revolution. So beginning of the control of the people through money. But yeah, I mean, and the other thing is, I wrote in my book, if you're interested, is called The Siege of Heaven Reader, which is really, it's not my writings. It's an anthology that I put together. It starts really at the time of the English Civil War and looks at the plot, Cromwell's plot, along with, because he's characterized by Walter Scott, the great writer, historical mm-hmm. novel, he invented the historical novel, as the bankrupt brewer of Huntingdon. Because apparently Cromwell had run a brewery in Huntingdon, and it's good that you're not...
Really? Not are you talking about Oliver Cromwell?
Yes, Oliver Cromwell had run a brewery in Huntingdon, and he'd failed. I mean, this was the way that the royalists took the mickey out of him. They said he couldn't even run a brewery, yeah? This guy, and it's one of the easiest ways to make money is you pour a load of malt, and then you ferment it, and you make loads of money out of it, and it's like free money. But Cromwell went bankrupt doing brewing, and so he was kind of at a loss, and he was looking to kind of affirm himself amongst the great and the good and the powerful. So he was their tool, you know, during the war. Anyhow, so I digress a bit talking about Dennis Weekly, but I think the English have really got to understand what went on there, because it set the stage for the empire. Very different to the American empire. I mean, we went around with Bibles and guns, and, you know, we had a bit more of a persuasive way. And also we were putting in water systems, things like that. You know, I'm not saying the British Empire was a great thing. We massacred the North Americans. Christ, I mean, you know, what happened over there is from Bristol here, where I'm talking to you from, John Cabot went over to, in 1497, over to North America on his little reconnaissance mission. You know, this is interesting. What's all this? Of course, I think probably they knew it was already there, but this was for the public's benefit because they wanted all these migrants to go out to colonize North America, and they wanted all the slaves out there to work as sort of slavery system. It's an archetype for what we're seeing today with these central bank digital currencies. Let's have everybody as little slaves that we can switch allowed to buy, what they're not. And isn't it interesting how this comes back to talking about Debbie Hicks and Nigel Farage having their bank accounts switched off, because Farage is fronting this campaign against central bank digital currencies. If you look online, you'll find his adverts and things like that on YouTube and all around the internet, saying, with Nigel Farage saying, everybody must beware, this is a really dangerous development, this central bank digital currency, blah blah blah. And here's how what you can do, and you can subscribe to some newsletter or other, pay I think it's 100 quid a year, and get some constant updates on how to protect your wealth, because they're coming for it with the central bank digital currencies. And also, it's a kind of fascistic slavery system. So he's put this out a couple of weeks ago, and all of a sudden, you know, his bank accounts are all switched off. So you don't need to be a genius to work out what's going on here. There is a faction out there, an elite faction, I would say, like the P2 in Italy in the 1980s, committees of people who just they are in charge, and they decide which politicians we're allowed to vote for. And at the end of the day, it's run by intelligence services, and the banksters mainly, but obviously the military, the top police are in there, the owners of the press, the Black Rocks, the Vanguards, the Larry Finks,
when you say it's run by representatives of the same elite families who now represent all of these entities, which are places where power resides for the time being until new technology comes, just like in the past. And one of the things that you talk about, I mean, I've got to stop there. Stop you there, because wow, I've had so many thoughts going through my mind, especially that a lot of my research that goes back to the time of when that empire was being built. It seems to be being built by necessity. So I did two separate articles about looking into family histories. One about Barbara Hewson, who was a very complicated lady who defended people like Rolf Harris and Jimmy Savile after they'd been caught. Live on on Channel 4 TV, you know, she balls out barrister, human rights barrister, and really a bit of a contrarian, from a family of contrarians, as I find out. And it's a really interesting, completely interesting that I went back into their history, back to like the, and go back through the 1400s and the 1500s in Britain. And then I went back through Bill Gates' ancestry, 700 years, and I ended up in the court of King Henry VIII, because Sir John Gates and Sir Geoffrey Gates III, Sir Geoffrey Gates III is a direct ancestor of Bill Gates, were in the court of Henry VIII. Actually, Sir John Gates walks alongside, as one of the pallbearers for Henry VIII's coffin when he died, and they become the advisors to the king, and then the next to his son Edward, and then when he dies young, and Mary takes over, they try and coup they try and put Jane Seymour on the throne, and then of course Mary Tudor has the heads chopped off on the first day she takes office, which is that's significant. Same people throughout history, and then the Gates family go into hiding before they run off to America. But that moment in history where you had this sudden power shift between the two, this Protestant and Catholic, and you had all of those people die under Mary Tudor, I think that was really the point that put fuel within the creation of that empire, because afterwards Elizabeth put a lot of effort into colonizing as much as possible, getting out of there. And I think it was maybe a projection from her own fear that at any moment the tables could turn and they could all be on the chopping block. So they needed places to have sanctuary, and people needed to have sanctuary. And at the same time, it helped build empire and accrue massive wealth during that period. So all of the benefits were there. And when you watch how they implemented that during that period, that's really the birth of the empire. Then all of the rest afterwards, like what you're talking about in the English Civil War, that's the forming of what had already been started there. And I think that's where it came from. Personally, I think the impetus was from that really significantly scary period in history where everybody started getting burnt in the streets and having their heads chopped off and the like. Everybody, that's a bit of an exaggeration. But it's really interesting that it leads us, like it propels us through history like this, and we end up, like you say, in the modern day, at the time where they're changing over a banking system. And this is really significant. What you're talking about, CBDCs, there is a battle about to start. And I talk to lots of crypto people on camera and behind the scenes who know that this is a war. So is this the type of war we're going to see in the future? Is this the next stage? Is the bankers, is this the next big thing?
Well, warfare, okay, so yes, there's shooting people and bombing them in warfare, but it's also, as we talked about before, psychological warfare. So that is conning people, lying to people, convincing people, leading them around like sheep, using the wonderful invention of television and, you know, whatever the internet, obviously, too, now. It's like the golden age of television in the 1970s and well, 60s and 70s mainly, where anyone could pretty much get a film onto TV, is gone or long gone. The same thing sort of seems to be happening with the internet now. So, you know, use it while you can, folks, because there's all sorts of, with the online safety bill, yeah, the idea, this is a universal thing. Look, every Western country is bringing in these controls, everyone, to make it kind of like China, you know, where you just can't have free speech anymore on the internet. So, you know, there's the psychological warfare, there's the economic warfare. That was where it was very much going on in between the wars, First World War and Second World War. It really started to become a thing that the intelligence services, the Foreign Office, would have a whole kind of economic warfare department, which was run by Desmond Morton, who went on to become Winston Churchill's private secretary during the Second World War. He'd been aide-de-camp to General Haig in the First World War. So, you can just trace these specific individuals who were, I find this fascinating, who've been involved in these, you know, the development of these evil systems of lying, control, warfare, whatever. We've also got, obviously, satellite warfare, space war, that sort of thing. We've got cyber warfare now. So there's a whole different, you know, ball game. And the Americans have rather stupidly said, well, if a cyber attack, that could be trigger a nuclear response. Really? Right? Well, and that cyber attack has come from where? From the NSA? Because they've also said, by the way, it's really impossible to tell where a cyber attack is from. So you're going to attack a country with a nuclear weapon for a cyber attack that you don't know where it's come from. I mean, this is the idiot. Well, it's not an idiotic logic. It's designed to demoralize people, and it's a kind of a signature of the despotism. And I'd like to just talk a little bit about some of the most recent stuff I've been looking into, got triggered for me by interviewing a brilliant guy. I think he's brilliant, David Livingstone, who wrote this book, Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea. And he's a Canadian, and his first book was called The Dying God, and it was looking at it's a brilliant title because he's looking at the way that the whole concept of God has been dying, you know, or being killed off. So, you know, in medieval times, pretty much everyone believed there was a, you know, purpose to it all, you know, and we were created children of God of one sort or another. Most people thought that. But now, of course, this is so-called silly idea, you know, and he looks at that. But he also, the title, The Dying God, is also to do with this sun worship where, you know, the sun dies in the evening and is resurrected every morning. So it's quite a clever title. And he goes into the really the dualistic challenge there's been over the millennia between the kind of Canaanite tradition and that turned into the Greek and Roman empires and all those Greek and Roman myths, as against the Judeo-Christian, biblical and Islamic tradition that's come through the Old Testament. These two kind of clashing ways of looking at the world. And, you know, and he also looks at the development of particularly of Christianity from the original Orthodox Church. I mean, the Catholics love to say, oh, we're the original church, Saint Peter founded it in Rome. No, you had a battle with the Orthodox Church in the 1100s, and or is it 10? I'm not quite sure. I think it was the 10th century, with the Orthodox Church. 1154, I think, was the Great Schism, where each of the popes excommunicated each other in Constantinople and Rome. And so you had the split from the Orthodox Church to the Catholics. And then in the 1500s, you had the Protestants, which was a remaking of the Catholic Church to make it morally okay to screw people, if you mind my language, with business and for the merchants to get on and just make loads and loads of money and make everybody that, you know, poor people work for them in factories and things like that. So that was another remaking of the whole faith. So I think this, that David, when I was chatting to David about all this and a bit about really more to do with the transhumanism side, which is his more recent books. And I was saying to him, where has this, a lot of this come from? And he mentioned this guy called Nick Land. Now, Nick Land is what he called the father of accelerationism. So this whole concept of accelerationism, where what you're doing is you're trying to move, change society, but change it faster and faster and faster. And you see all of the top people, the Schwabs, so-called top people, and the Hararis and Larry Fink, you know, the BlackRock guy. And they're all using this term all the time. And it's become a buzzword, accelerate. We've got to accelerate this. Starmer uses it, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sunak uses it. So we've got to accelerate. So anyway, accelerationism. And he was talking about Nick Land as the father of X. Anyway, I said to us, at the end of the interview, I finished the interview with him. I said, who is this Nick Land? Who is he? Tell me a bit more about him. And he said, he was a philosophy professor at Warwick University, went to Sussex University, studied for. And I said, hang on, I know him. I went to school with him. And so this was David in his interview says, no way. But I did. I was friends with this guy. I used to call him Nazi Nick at school.
I was wondering why his nickname was going to be. I was guessing Nicky Knickers or something. He used to wear knickers on his head or something. But that is more descriptive. And go on.
So anyway, so he was he was a fascinating character. He really was. And he was a good mate of mine, actually, even though he was a Nazi, because he had this dark sense. He had a dark sense of humor. And he was always into doing stuff. We used to sit and play war games, you know, these tabletop war games on a Saturday around his house. His mum would bring us sandwiches and stuff. And his dad worked for Shell, by the way. He was a director of Shell in South Africa in the 1970s. That wasn't the coolest thing in the world to be. But anyway, so we'd be playing like the Six-Day War over a few hours. And then, on a Saturday with a group of mates, it was called Diplomacy Club. And so we started off playing diplomacy. So this is what I did as a 13, 14 year old kid. And then to find that he's become the father of accelerationism was a bit bizarre. And so I've been looking more and more into this. He's out in Shanghai now, which is the old opium capital, the financial capital of China. And the whole point of this is, I think, to understand what they're doing, which is, I mean, Harari, he's written this thing called The Dark Enlightenment, which is a manifesto, which is looking at the old Enlightenment from, the Masonic thing after the Civil War. So from the 1700s, mainly, the idea of everyone can talk about religion as much as they want, and there's no kind of sanction from the church, which there used to be. You can't say this, you can't, this is blasphemy, you're going to prison, you're having your head. So getting rid of that, and also opening up the whole debate around science, which was the Royal Society. So, for example, the Royal Society in Edinburgh was chaired by John Robison, or secretary was John Robison, who wrote this brilliant, amazing book, The Proofs of a Conspiracy Against All Religions and Governments, which was a look at the way that the Freemasonry that he joined, which was a speakeasy and a Christian thing, supposedly, was being taken over by these Illuminists, the Illuminati, and that there was a satanic side to it. So John Robison is writing about this stuff. He's also mates with James Watt, who is inventing the steam engine. So that's your original Enlightenment. Now, next thing is the Dark Enlightenment. So this is all about machines controlling humans. Humans keep messing things up. We keep making a mess of things. We're not very good. Actually, of course, the fact is we're great. We're wonderful, but we keep getting manipulated and steered and messed around with by banksters, etc. But he wants the humanity to be enslaved by machines. He thinks that's going to be a good thing. And he wants to get rid of what he calls the cathedral, which is all these other sort of civil society things like, you know, religions, trade unions, all these things, other things that get in the way of machines controlling humanity. So he's got this. The other thing, Johnny, is that, you know, he's also very much into hallucinogenic drugs. I mean, he kind of got into that as I wasn't. You know, he kind of unfriended me when we got to about 16. But the idea that somebody who's into this stuff at that early age, he was into William Gibson, all that kind of thing, should then be dropping acid on a very, very mega regular basis. He's then getting into a very, I think, dark direction. Mm-hmm. And so then he went to Warwick. He was kicked out of Warwick University, allegedly for giving LSD to his philosophy students. Mm-hmm. And also someone was telling me, who was one of his students up there, that they were conjuring demons or trying to. Nick was trying to conjure demons in the philosophy department at Warwick University. So anyway, he's ended up in China. So I just think it's and the basics here are this dark enlightenment and accelerationism is always the same. So what they do is create a crisis. So this could be a cost of living crisis. It could be a COVID crisis. It could be a climate crisis. All sorts of crises. Oh, well, no, isn't it terrible? And they have a massive load of mass media fuss-potting about it, exaggerate it. And then the solution, which has already been pre-prepared, just makes things far worse. So this is a philosophy, I think, which is the West is in the grip of, right? It's a Nietzschean philosophy. Nick was a Nietzsche. And so the idea is that this is almost programmed into the entire civil society. And how can you do that? You might say, we live in a democracy. Rubbish. The Bilderbergers, which is another area of my study, have kind of completely got a stranglehold on policy now through their contacts in the press, in the banking sector, and particularly in politics. We've got David Lammy. God, I mean, he's about to become foreign secretary in charge of foreign policy. We saw him last month at the Bilderberg conference in Lisbon, which I always recommend people, if you can find out where it's going to be, go there, because Lammy was turning up at Bilderberg, and he didn't have the right credentials to get in, so the security kept him at the gate. We had this with Ed Balls a few years ago as well, and they stood there in this embarrassing fashion, so all us photographers can kind of swarm around and get loads of pictures of embarrassed Lammy, who's, he's not. I actually said under my breath, I said, "Hey man, you're not important enough," Anyway, so so he then went off. He didn't like having his photograph taken. He wasn't being let in. So he went and hid behind a tree, behind a bush nearby. And he's on the phone to them. "Please let me in. Can you come and send someone to let me in?" And they sent somebody out. They'd already had sent somebody out, one of the security, Bilderberg security people, to say, "Look," and then they're going, "Where is he? Where's he gone? He's not here anymore. He's hiding around." So Giorgio is this lovely guy who comes to most of the Bilderberg things, who's originally Italian, lives in Belgium now. He actually took the security guard around behind the bush to show where Lammy was hiding,
Oh, my Lord.
Then Lammy eventually manages to get into the Bilderberg meeting. So, in a nutshell, Bilderberg is the NATO lobby. It's the military-industrial complex, the evil empire, basically deciding who we can and cannot have as candidates to be, prime minister or leader of the opposition or whatever. And it's one up from the World Economic Forum, I'd say, because it's just the NATO countries. And it is a kind of parallel secret government. And that's how I think they make sure that these various policies, accelerationist policies, it's proper gender. The idea is the entire national debate is controlled. So you've got a crisis and a reaction. And all of those things are just taking away all of our... I mean, look at what's been going on with the climate stuff and net zero. I mean, the destruction of farming in Holland. And of course, if we had a left-wing government here, the same would be going on in Britain. The farmers would be being decimated, being told, too many of your cows are farting, you're going to have to cut down your number of livestock, which is already very low on historic levels with all these solar panels everywhere, and they're down by 90%. And you're also not allowed to use fertilizers, or we're taxing you. Now, the Dutch farmers have got just a really simple slogan, which they've been, it's brilliant to see the protests. We don't see them on the TV, of course, which is "No farmers, no food." And of course, it doesn't take a genius to work out what's going on here. There's a structural starvation of the population being prepared. And the land is at the back of it, like it was back in the enclosures, Johnny, and the things that led to the Civil War, is these private equity firms and the banksters are coming for the land, not just the farmland, but also your house. You know, so when you can't pay the mortgage or the council tax is jacked up so much that you can't pay that, you have to sell your house. And you might be able to still live there for a few years, but it's going to be owned by HSBC. It's going to be owned by Vanguard or Blackstone or whatever. So they're coming for the land that we need to grow our food in and to live on. And if we can't grow food and we can't live, well, we really are their slaves, aren't we?
Yeah, and I see massive similarities between English Civil War and now, for sure, the run-up to it, and the way life is, you know, the infrastructure is being manipulated by those in power. Hey, when you're talking about, did you say his name, Nick Land? Did you say Land?
Nick Land. Talking,
yeah, accelerationism. And now, a couple of things. First of all, anybody who knows me knows that I accredit psychedelics, or at least the use of psychedelics, to get to a better place. But if I had done that when I was a kid or young, I would never have got to a better place, because you have to have a really strong mind to understand what's happening and to understand what is real and what is an illusion. And psychedelics doesn't help you do that. So from a very young age, I do think there are qualities that it can bring to somebody's life.
Listen, I agree. You know, I agree.
Yeah. But
David Nutt, who was the chief advisor on drugs to the government, has just brought out a book all about the benefits of psychedelics.
Yeah, but I
would say, you know, in one word, I would say, take a tiny bit. None of this loads and loads of psych, you know, whatever they do with ayahuasca or whatever, it's not something which is a good idea to do a lot of, you know.
I've only done that when I come to the point when I just didn't want to keep going anymore, and then I was like, there's a choice to make, and I spent 3 months making a lot of choices and looking at myself and being able to tackle issues that I could never tackle outside. But this isn't about that. One of my points about this is that the type of person that then goes and says, well, I know more because I've taken LSD, get other people to start taking LSD so they know more, and then they can usually use that to control. I've sat with people and taking it. I prefer to take those sort of things alone, because I've been with people who try to change your mind and manipulate your mind while you're on it. And he sounds like exactly that type of person. Sounds like it. Maybe he's not, but he sounds like that type of person, that Noah Yuval Noah Harari and these guys. I've studied them quite a bit, and I've looked at what they're doing, and it's very
I say stick to the natural stuff, stick to the magic mushrooms, have one or two or three, you know, not 100. Like, some people just think the more I have, the more amazing it's going to be, man. And also, you know, you're seeing, like, you know, whatever hallucinations you might or might not be seeing is just it's just made up in your head. What a lot of people do is they think, well man, I'm seeing the real reality. No. What you're seeing in a hallucination is just a dream, really. And it's a terrible, terrible mistake which a lot of people make, is to think, well, I've seen the real world as it really is. No, it's a way of exploring yourself. Really.
It's a way of exploring yourself, because it disconnects you from your.
Do it legally, and if you really have to, tiny amounts, and like baby steps, you know.
But it's like for me, it's like there's it allows you to have a look at things without that judgment of yourself and the judgment of other people around. When you take something like that, you're able to detach yourself from that sense of always judging yourself, and then suddenly you're able to be more expressive. And it's true, if you, what you're saying to microdose, is a fantastic way just to chill out and have a talk with someone and chat through your problems, a lot like many different drugs can do. But the point is how they use them and how other people use them, because I really mean, I've sat in a room with someone who I didn't think that I have the level of like sort of I've had experience with psychedelics that I had, and tried to manipulate me. A couple of people, in actual fact, who have tried to manipulate me, and I know they're trying to manipulate me. So you know, you have to do these things with the most trustworthy person. I'm trying
to manipulate you now. Yeah, by saying there is a reason why it is illegal, and it's because it can destroy your mind. You know, true. This is why I say, if you're going to do it in a, you know, in a very nurturing environment, and do it legally, and do it with a tiny micro doses, and don't use the chemicals.
And
use the
don't become a Nazi accelerationist. basically, that's one of the things that you also don't want to do.
There's a really good article about the death trip, right? Which is talking about Nick Land. You'll find it out there somewhere. I've tried to approach the guy. He hasn't got back to me. He wrote that, but he's saying, look, this guy is just, you know, he's on a death trip, and he's trying to drag everyone else down with him, effectively. So, I've actually tried to get hold of Nick through a mutual friend to interview him about all this from Shanghai, but unfortunately he's not got back to me. It's just weird seeing it. I've seen talks of him, and I just remember, you know, I remember the same intonations of the voice from sort of 13-14 years old. But then look, also just to bring this stuff up to sort of really relevant today, and the struggle of people like Julian Assange. I mean, we still don't hear enough really about him on the news, and it should be all the time. All the journalists out there that don't seem to really care that too much about what happens to Julian. Of course, it's a massively important thing. And I've on this week's program got an interview with the guy that took over from Julian as the editor of WikiLeaks, a really lovely bloke, as an Icelandic investigative journalist. And we don't hear much about that, because of course most of the campaign is now to get him out off of this charge. One of the most interesting things he was telling me was that the charges against Julian may have nothing to do with the military. That if you look at the actual substance of the charges under the Espionage Act, they're talking about him releasing sensitive information to the public. Well, they didn't. They sent the, they released the information to the newspapers with very clear instructions that you mustn't be printing. This is just for your information and not to be published. These names are very important. You don't publish them. So they didn't publish them. The Guardian did. The New York Times did. And so the question is, what really has Julian done which has upset them more than anything else? And the answer seems to be the documents that they published during the after the 2008 banking crisis, about the evidence that it was deliberate and that the bankers had been doing it deliberately. Well, WikiLeaks published a whole load of that stuff. And in fact, several bankers around the world were jailed as a result. Quite long sentences, 5, 6, 7 years in prison for what WikiLeaks released.
A load of other bankers who were involved in that are now World Economic Forum Young Global Leaders from the past couple of years, only the past couple of years.
That's right. And the other thing I must say is, you know, I'm a Christian, that is to say I was brought up sort of Church of England, you know, going to local church, but then I realized kind of that there was something missing in the Church of England. Eventually came around to become a Quaker, but the point is that this Christian tradition is really important as a moral kind of anchor to sort of. And also, I believe historically, absolutely, you know, the history of the Jews is an absolutely brilliant, amazing tale, but it's true. I think that's what did happen. You know, Moses did come out of the slavery of Pharaoh in Egypt, and they did set off to that part of the world, and God did sort that place out for them, you know, and looked after these people. I mean, the Jewish religion, race, whatever you want to call it, they are an amazing bunch of people. I mean, they can be flawed and they can be bad and good just like anyone else, but I've over the years learned a tremendous amount of wisdom from people brought up in the Jewish tradition. Obviously what's going on over in Palestine is hideous, disgusting. It's a kind of hijacking of that faith. Completely. And isn't it handy how the rabbinic tradition in Europe, which would now be opposing what's going on in Palestine, it was massacred by Hitler. So that rabbinic tradition, the sort of ordinary normal Jews from right over Europe, were just put into the mincing machine. And so there's been this Zionist kind of fake version of the religion has been created, the same as the, you know, your Al-Qaeda's a fake version of Islam, and the same as the Christian Zionist nutters are the fake version of the Christianity. Mm-hmm. So these various faiths have been occupied, and all you see on television is that, oh, the nutty Christian, you know, vicar's a pervert, and, you know, so they it's perfect to give the faith a really bad press. I've finished up by saying, by my little religious rant, if you want, is look at the book of Revelation. My God, this stuff is all happening. You know, the mark of the beast, for God's sake, is happening. You know, the idea of the image of the beast, which is this animated statue, robotics, is all happening right now. And, you know, it's difficult to know, to piece it all together, but you can see for sure, if someone comes along to you and says, hey, we're going to put a microchip in your hand just there, or maybe we'll put one in your forehead, you know, and if you're one of the really super elite, you can have it there, and it'll make your transactions so much easier. And this is obviously written by John. Actually, it was Procurus, who was his little scribe, the Apostle John, on Patmos, about 90 AD. And there was all sorts of battles over the centuries to keep it in and out of the Bible. But I think, you know, now is the time to dust off your Bible, have a look at that book of Revelation, see what it's saying, because it's speaking to us, I think, very much. The idea of the four horsemen of the apocalypse as well is really important, because this is a signal. It's saying, look, you know, this is going to get really, really rough, but keep your faith. And the idea of the four horsemen is, look, when these events start happening, I'm not going to say what, you know, what they are. I think they're to do with a war, they're to do with a famine, and they're also to do with economic collapse. I think the black horse is economic collapse, and the pale horse is disease and famine, killing loads of people. But these four horsemen of the apocalypse is God saying, look, guys, you know, it's going to get rough, but keep the faith. Don't worry, because, well, you know, you obviously might well be worried when you're on death's door, or there's a war's going on and the sky goes dark or whatever. And the other thing is read The Lord of the Rings. The Lord of the Rings is a fantastic allegory for all of this. And Tolkien was weaving in a lot of the imagery that we look around, in the Illuminati imagery with the Eye of Sauron. You've got the traitor Saruman, which is the Freemason, the white hand of the Freemasons. Mm-hmm. And so he's weaving in all of that, you know, the treacherous people we have around us, maybe even within our own family. Certainly, mm-hmm. you know, in our civic society, there are traitors out there who are selling us out. They want us dead. They want us out of the way. So this is all in there for that sort of final battle, which, of course, the good people win ultimately. Yeah. Now, quite how it all transpires, I don't know. We may not be alive to see it. We probably won't. But the fact is that it's not just about, you know, the goodness of humanity will prevail. There is a plan unfolding. And the bad guys, well, you know, what's happened is they're at war with Russia right now. And they're also at war with their own people. So they're isolating themselves slowly but surely. They're becoming less and less and less people that will actually do these evil deeds and enslave humanity, that have the arrogance to think that they are gods. You know, oh, God is just a load of silly rubbish and nonsense. I'm a god. I can do what I want. Look, you know, look, I can make all these people kill themselves with COVID vaccines. Ha ha, aren't I clever? You know, this is their attitude. They like the idea of being able to sort of con people into their own demise. And, so I think that's what we're up against in this kind of spiritual war, Johnny. And I see it, you know, in the pages of Revelation sort of opening up bit by bit. These bits and pieces in that book are being put into place. It talks about locusts, you know, locust-like things.
I tell the people out there, if you want an amazing telling of Revelations, you should be listening to Vangelis and Demi Russo, an Aphrodite's Child, 666, Mark of the Beast, that tells... double album that tells of everything, including the plague of the locust, and that is one hell of a bit of progressive rock.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think we're talking here, because if they'd have seen a drone, you know, in a vision back in 90 AD, that was, well, it's like that, isn't it? I don't know what it is, but it's a bit like a locust.
That is a fantastic. I'd love to go into this in much more detail on another time, because that is exactly based on a note of the post-World War, when they created the CIA, the majority of the people who formed the CIA, including Kermit Roosevelt and others, were really strong anti-Zionists. They believed the idea of creation of the state of Israel and under the banner of Zionism by these Zionist actors was a really bad idea for the future. And they fought really hard against it up until they were defeated around 1966, 1967. Eventually, the tide turned against them. And then after that, everybody was on board. Or most of the powerful were on board and knew they had to be on board by that point. The tide had turned. So there's a history that I think always surprises people when you tell people about that. I've seen people who are really angry about Israel and Zionism who don't know that part of history. They think that America has been on board the entire time and everybody's been on board, but
here's a little tale which was revealed in the Silurian blog in the Daily Telegraph must be 15 years ago now, which was that Jim Morrison, the Doors singer's father, he was an admiral in the Sixth Fleet, which is the Mediterranean fleet mm-hmm. for the US, and that was involved in the Six-Day War. And USS Liberty was in the Sixth Fleet, and of course the admiral of the fleet, with his sitting in his aircraft carrier or wherever he was, is saying, hang on, the Israelis have just attacked one of my boats and tried to sink it. Let's do a raid on the Israeli air bases. And this is in the height of the Six-Day War. So the planes, the aircraft were actually scrambled, the Phantom jets from the aircraft carriers, and were heading off to bomb the Israelis when Lyndon Johnson called him up and said, bring the planes back, we're not retaliating, we're mm-hmm. not going to fight the Israelis. So that was a quite an important moment where, you know, the powers that be, obviously Johnson was involved in the assassination of JFK, was very, very much involved in it, as Edgar Hoover was, and the Texas barons hiring the Chicago mob, including the rather accurate
I'd hitman. Love to go into that as well, because I mean I talked with Corey Hughes about that, and I always find that Lyndon B. Johnson looks like he was in complete shell shocked when it happened. I felt to think they kept him at a certain distance here and there, but he knew certain parts of it, and it all he didn't know it was going to be then and there and quite
but it's Marion details. I think, and his girlfriend's name is Marion, and she was, I'm not sure if she was Lyndon Johnson's girlfriend or Edgar Hoover's. She was in a brilliant ITV documentary about who killed JFK from the 1980s. And she just says, it's in my book, by the way. I transcribed it all. That is to say, The Siege of Heaven Reader. And it's where she describes being at H.R. Hunt, I think his name is, house, mm-hmm. the night before the assassination. Lyndon Johnson saying to her, the Kennedy brothers will never bother me again. They had a big meeting there with Hoover and the rest of them. And they hired James Files and Charles Nicoletti, Johnny Roselli from the Chicago Mafia, three hitmen, to come down and to kill JFK. And this was mainly because of the fiasco of the Bay of Pigs. There were a lot of people who had been training for the Bay of Pigs and the takeover of Cuba, and Kennedy refused to include the US Air Force to do cover for their invasion, and so a lot of them died. It was all humiliating, and they hated Kennedy for that main reason. But this was really just an excuse to take out. And isn't it interesting how his nephew was his father was killed afterwards, RFK. About 8 years afterwards, was assassinated because he wanted to open up the reopen the inquiry into JFK's killing. Mm-hmm. And now his son is in the running for the Democratic nomination. This is a fascinating thing. Complete news blackout on this, by the way, even though it's such a fascinating story.
Yeah, completely. Completely interesting. I think it was about 5 years. I think it was 68 that RFK. And only That's I only right. know that because I just looked into it recently. Listen, thank you for all your time. We've got so much to talk about in the future. We're on the same wavelength now. I'm glad I caught up with you. It's taken me a bit of a while, but I've got a lot of reading to do. So I'm going to go and look into your work and your books and really start start trying to take in what's going on. So So
I've got another that book I was telling you about, The Siege of Heaven Reader, is a sort of
you're classed as editor.
Yeah, it's an anthology, so mm-hmm. Which I edited, which is all the way from the English Civil War to the assassination of Diana. And there's a lot about, you know, why Charles was involved in that and, you know, why she was in the way, why she was so problematic, why she had to be murdered. Well, of course it is. You know, do we want a wife murderer as king? I mean, that's a question that I think should be...
The people in power do.
So there's that, you know, and it also shows, doesn't it, how... the evildoers are really getting smaller and smaller in number and having to kind of stay together in their cults because they realize any kind of outsiders might just betray them or might not be reliable. It's a control freak. It's the same as the fall of Rome. This is what happened with Rome. So there's that, The Siege of Heaven Reader. That's 20 quid, but it's, you know, it's an easy thing to dip into. Loads and loads of stuff about hidden government, secret government through history from the English Civil War up to the, and then I did an investigation into the Bilderbergers and Martin Bormann, who was Hitler's private secretary, because I came across some individuals who'd been involved in World War II who were responsible for getting Martin Bormann out of Berlin just before, literally the few days before the end of the Second World War, by canoe. And it was commandos trained down in Hayling Island, plus some Jewish commandos. And of course, the thing, Bormann, he as a person had to be brought out because he was a signatory to all the major Nazi bank accounts. So around about $1 billion, which in 1945 was a lot more than a billion now, in Switzerland, Argentina, etc. And he was responsible for the whole sort of plan to recreate the Third Reich, you know, industrial, economic Fourth Reich after the war. But so he had a lot of money, and so he was doing deals all around the world with the Brits at the end of the war. So this is really looking at how that ended up with the same people involved in the Battle of Arnhem, which provided the extra time Bormann needed to secrete the Nazi wealth around the world and get his plans all ready to go, that they were the ones that were chosen, the ones that threw the fight in Arnhem to do things like chair the Bilderberg conferences for 20 years, as Prince Bernhard did. Peter Carrington, he also became a chairman of the Bilderberg meeting before he died. He was in charge of... he was a defence secretary when we had Bloody Sunday, for example, and the parachute regiment massacring people. So these individuals can be very much directly connected back to this battle in World War II and also to the recreation of the Nazis as an industrial empire and a massive bunch of cartels, where the clever thing they did, I mean, there's two books really that I got most of the information, plus a few individuals that came to me with extra information. One is called Op JB by Christopher Crichton, which looks at the escape of Bormann to London eventually and out of Berlin at the end of the war. And then the second one is Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, written by CBS journalist Paul Manning. And Paul wrote this in the 1980s, but he had discovered Bormann over in South America, creating all these businesses, laundering the cash from the loot of the war through Sullivan and Cromwell law firm, which was the Dulles Brothers law firm in New York, into these new companies. And the clever thing they did was many of the companies were fronted by Jews. So there'd be a Jew as a chairman, so no one would ever suspect that company was actually financed from the Nazi loot of World War II. Very, very smart, you know. So it's called The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group. So it's looking at the creation of the links between the Bilderbergers and the creation of this Fourth Reich. And the final one is just an ebook, and that is just it's called The Siege of Heaven, which is a look at a bunch of my articles I did for RT and some that RT wouldn't use, and others that I've written since. So I've done one on the cost of living crisis, which is looking at housing and the way that the price of housing is being used to force the cost of living crisis in, and even the Labour Party is trying to take people's houses off them, you know. So and then the other one is to look at the English Civil War and the witchcraft and the run-up to the English Civil War and the way that the the Protestant Reformation, because the Catholics had been really hopeless in prosecuting witchcraft cases, and so the Protestants all started getting involved. We know there's some witches, we're going to prosecute them. And it's the way that the witchcraft system was used by Cromwell to organize the conspiracy to do a judicial kind of assassinate, a bit like they're trying to do to Trump, the character assassination of Boris and all these. I mean, this is becoming a normal thing now in Brazil, etc. Lula and Dilma Rousseff before him have been, it's almost like as soon as Bolsonaro's just come out of power, no, they're going to put him on trial, attempt to control, to make sure that anybody that looks like they might be a decent leader is put on trial and taken through the courts and stopped from even standing. That sort of thing was going on way back in the English Civil War as well. So that's called The Siege of Heaven, but it's just an ebook. My weekly, Bilderberg.org has been there for a long time, just hanging around with
background. It is one hell of a hulk of a load of information in there, I tell you.
I mean, that a lot of that I got from the Bodleian Library when I was living in Oxford in the 1990s and just literally scanned in and put it up online because it's all background on who the Bilderbergers were. I mean, it just got my goat that you've got the chairman of the Bilderberg for the first 20 years is a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. No one's supposed to bat an eyelid. And then I do a weekly radio show, which is we were booted off even off silly little community radio here in Bristol on FM. That was during COVID because we've been covering Andrew Wakefield all the questions about MMR vaccines and
can't do that, Tony.
This is it. The Bristol Mafia didn't. I mean, I'm also criticising our mayor here, who's a Yale World Fellow, Marvin East, and his dad was involved very much in the underground and in the 1980s. Mm-hmm. In fact, in a court case where he was accused of trying to murder the leader of the anti-apartheid group in Bristol. I mean, he's a black guy. So, I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why the Bristol establishment don't like me. I've been also involved in exposing the Merchant Venturers, who are this organisation set up after the discoverer. Yeah, they were set up after the discovery of North America to exploit it, and they're involved. But they're still there. The Hewsons
were involved in a Yorkshire version of it that was like, it's amazing. I've done research on that before. It's a really interesting moment. It's that moment of we're going to take over the world.
Well, the thing is that they are a sort of local Illuminati. Who the hell are these people? There's 120 of them apparently. Their accounts are not visible to journalists because it's all under a royal charter. Only the Privy Council can scrutinise their accounts. And if you look at, it's very difficult to understand exactly what they're about. But one thing you can always do is their shareholdings will allow them to nominate people onto boards of companies. So you can see where their shares are because they're putting their people, who's another merchant venturer, onto this company. Mm-hmm. In fact, sometimes they do that before they've even become. So there's this whole group of businesses in Bristol of people that want to join the merchant venturers so their kids will never have to work and they can spend their whole life playing golf if they want, because the shares that they own, Johnny, are, you can see, it's things like the water company, the electricity company, the gas, all the stuff that Thatcher privatized. They bought all the shares up, and every time you turn on a light bulb or you switch the tap on, the money is going to them.
They're hitting another golf ball into the bunker. That's it.
Exactly. So that's thisweek.org.uk. You can catch the show, and there's also an app which Nick, lovely Nick from Poland, well, he's a Brit who lives in Poland.
Not Nazi creation. Nick, a different Nick.
No, definitely a different Nick. Yeah, completely opposite. Yeah. And it's called Not the BCFM Politics Show app. I know it's quite a mouthful. Not the BCFM Politics Show. Stick that on your phone and it will ping you about 15 minutes before the show starts on a Friday. So you can listen live or you can download the show afterwards on the app, or you can listen to, because I have longer clips. And if you found a little clip I've used, a short clip, interesting, you can go and listen to the full interview on the app, or you can just download it off the website thisweek.org.uk, Johnny.
Awesome. Excellent. Listen, that's a load of information. I'm sure people, a load of people in my audience, they're already going to know you. But I'm sure every time they listen to you, they learn a load of new information. And thanks for giving me your time. I know you're a bit busy. So I really appreciate it. Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, so it's great that there's people like you and I helping people navigate the minefield, because there's loads and loads and loads of really sophisticated rubbish out there. Mm. And so that's what we try and do every week, is help people through it.
Well, it's appreciated, and thanks for talking to me today.
Okay, Johnny, take care.